It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time this weekend is the On Wisconsin annual spring powwow. We'll talk to a member of Wunkshik, UW-Madison's Native American student organization, which hosts that event.
The First Waukesha has been in the news the last few years for its plan to divert nearly 10 million gallons of water a day from Lake Michigan for its water supply.
But that plan has some members of the Great Lakes Compact crying foul.
Most recently, Michigan Attorney General Brad Schutte announced yesterday that the state wants a further review of Waukesha's plan.
Schutte argues that Waukesha doesn't meet the criteria both in terms of need and location to request water from the Great Lakes.
Joining us now to talk about this news is Peter Annan. He's the co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and the author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So to begin with, can we get a brief overview of why Waukesha is looking to divert water from Lake Michigan?
Yeah, so it's a community that has for years now been sitting atop a depleted water aquifer, and also it's naturally contaminated with a radioactive element known as radium. And so they have both the water quality and a water quantity issue that they've been dealing with for several years.
And so given that and the time that this has taken to unfold so far, is this announcement from Michigan Attorney General Schutte a surprise?
I guess it's not really a huge surprise because Michigan, which calls itself the Great Lakes State, has always been what I call the most vigorous vetter of Great Lakes water diversion requests. And the Attorney General and the Governor both have always been, no matter who's been in those offices, have always been very outspoken about these kinds of things. And so not that it was specifically expected, you know, yesterday from Attorney General Schutte to submit this letter, but it's not unexpected either that a person in his position in that state would be sending a letter of this sort.
Now, this is something that we've reported on in the past here on Central Time. Why do you think it's taken this long to get this sort of reaction from Michigan?
Oh, well, the Waukesha application was forwarded in January, and it's sent to the other jurisdictions. All eight Great Lakes states, as you know, are reviewing it, and all eight Great Lakes governors have to vote on it, and all it takes is one gubernatorial vote and Waukesha will be out of luck. But it's a very complicated issue. The compact is a very complicated document under which this application will be judged. And so these things definitely take time. And so we're on schedule now. The public comment period closed out on March 14th. And so now we're still getting some other comments from officials here, like Attorney General Schutte. And then we expect what I would call a preliminary decision on Waukesha in April, and then a final decision, a final vote from the governors in May or June.
Now, as I understand it, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett offered to sell water to Waukesha in order for them to drop this plan to divert water from Lake Michigan. Why wasn't that considered a good solution for the city, at least by the city of Waukesha?
Well, it actually would be part. It's just that right now Waukesha's application is getting water from the Milwaukee suburb of Oak Creek, and then Milwaukee was one of the other potential water suppliers, and for a wide variety of reasons, Waukesha and their current version of their application has selected Oak Creek as their preferred water supplier.
So that's something that could be an aspect of this unfolding story, sounds like.
It could be. Yeah, it could be. I don't think that Waukesha will change its mind on that, but it's something that could potentially change.
And Attorney General Schutte from Michigan says that meeting the strict exception standard here is what's key. Can you tell us a little bit about what that includes?
Yeah, so a community in near the basin line like Waukesha does have a right to request a Great Lakes water diversion. That doesn't mean they're going to get it, but they do have a right to request that. If you're not on or near the Great Lakes basin line, you can't even ask for a Great Lakes water diversion. So they're really in a special category. And then they have to prove that the water will only be used for public water supply, that they don't have a reasonable water supply alternative, that there won't be any adverse environmental impacts to the Great Lakes from this diversion, and then most importantly that they will return the water to the Great Lakes after it's used and cleaned the Clean Water Act standards.
We're talking right now with Peter Annan from Northland College. He's the author of The Great Water Wars. We're talking about news that Michigan's Attorney General is challenging Waukesha over its plan to divert water from Lake Michigan. And we just read through the conditions that are supposed to be met for this to go forward. It's a pretty steep list of things that have to be proved. How close is Waukesha to doing those things?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there have been a lot of questions raised. All the questions that the Attorney General raises in his letter have been raised by come out in the public hearing process, which has been very extensive. Hundreds of people showed up for a public hearing in February in Waukesha. And there have also been listening sessions in the state of Michigan, listening sessions in the state of Minnesota, and all these issues that are here are coming out. Do they really not have a reasonable water supply alternative? Is their conservation program top-notch? And then the biggest issue has been this issue about what's called so-called expanded water supply service area, and that Waukesha's application doesn't just include water for the city of Waukesha, but also a few neighboring communities. And there have been a lot of questions from all sorts of people about whether or not those additional communities, that additional water supply service area, really has met the letter of the law and the Great Lakes Compact.
And is there any mechanism in place? You've talked about these listening sessions, but what else can be done to ascertain that, yes, all of these conditions are being met, and here's the proof?
Well, I think the next thing that's going to happen is that in April, the end of April, April 21st, towards the end of April, there's going to be a meeting of what's called the regional body, and they're going to release technical findings on the application. And that's where we're going to really find out where the officials who have a say see the weaknesses and whether or not the application itself meets the letter of the law and the compact or not. And so we've heard from the public. And in the past, the public hearing process in the Great Lakes Basin has had a big influence on these kinds of water diversion decisions. So it's not generally in the past has not been a pro forma kind of a thing. And the public has come out in droves, both in support and in opposition to the Waukesha water diversion application. So it's going to be a really fascinating moment in Great Lakes water management history. First, later on this month, 3 weeks from today, and then, like I said, in May and June when we have the final decision.
Now, looking at what Waukesha has requested, it is, on the face of it, the number sounds pretty large, 10 million gallons of water per day. Is that a lot of water? Put that in context for us.
Yeah, no, that's really a great question. So it does sound like a lot of water. I mean, anything that's in the million sounds like a lot. But there are 6 quadrillion gallons of water in the entire Great Lakes Basin. And I don't know how many specifically they are in Lake Michigan, which is where this water diversion would come from. But it would be almost impossible to measure the amount of water that will be coming out with this Waukesha water diversion. So it's really not specifically a controversy about whether or not this one diversion will impact the Great Lakes. It's more a controversy about, since this is the first test case of its kind under the Great Lakes Compact, whether legally it will be setting a bad precedent that over time future leaders will look back on with regret. That's the key issue here.
And the situation of Waukesha is part of this as well, isn't it? As I understand it, it might not be technically in the Great Lakes Basin.
Yeah, so the specifics, exception clause under the compact that Waukesha falls under is a complicated one called the straddling county exception clause. And what that means is if it's a community like Waukesha that is clean and clear outside the Great Lakes Basin, but it resides in a county that straddles the Great Lakes Basin line, it has a right to ask for a Great Lakes water diversion. Again, if it meets all those strict standards that we talked about before, returning the water, having no adverse environmental impacts, et cetera. But because it's a community that sits clear and clean outside the Great Lakes Basin, as you mentioned, Veronica, has a really high bar, that water diversion application has to be approved by every Great Lakes governor from Minnesota to New York, a really high bar, and it's going to be fascinating to see what happens.
Right, so it has that right to ask, but it sounds like you're saying that the fact of it may weaken its case.
Well, it's always been a controversial aspect of the Great Lakes Compact that there was even a straddling county exception clause in it. And so that's been one of the more controversial aspects of the Great Lakes Compact from the beginning. On the other hand, if this part of the Great Lakes Compact wasn't included in the document, it never would have been adopted by the Wisconsin legislature, it never would have gone to Congress, and it never actually would be a law today. So it was one of those compromise issues in the negotiating room, and here we are with the first test case of this aspect of the compact, and so we're really going to see how people really feel about it in the gubernatorial offices in the Great Lakes Basin.
And Peter, just very briefly, if Waukesha does end up diverting water from Lake Michigan, would this be a precedent for other municipalities that aren't in the basin to divert water?
It would be a precedent for other municipalities that aren't in the basin if they are also in a straddling county. So this is not a precedent that would divert water to Arizona or Las Vegas. It just is setting a precedent for other communities that are either right on the basin line or right near the basin line in a county that straddles the line.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Peter Annan is the co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and the author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. He joined us to talk about Michigan's Attorney General challenging Waukesha over its plan to divert water from Lake Michigan.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're listening to a clip of Randy's song from Midnight Express, a native drumming group. You might hear music like these over the weekend at the Alliant Energy Center during the 47th annual On Wisconsin Annual Spring Powwow.
Faith Bowman joins us now to talk about this weekend's event. She's a second-year student at UW-Madison and a member of Wunkshik, UW-Madison's Native American student organization. They host the powwow. She's also a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians. Faith, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is a powwow for people who haven't been to one, who don't know what they are?
Sure. So a powwow is a social gathering for the Native peoples. It's just a way for us to come together, sing, dance, visit, and renew our connections with one another. And it's also a way for us to pass on traditions. So you see at many powwows, you know, there's dancers from all walks of life. You have elders, young adults, even babies who are dancing around and wearing their regalias. And the regalias themselves are ways to present who they are and what tribe they're from. So it's just a big social gathering.
And the regalia is something that people might see and think, oh, that's the costume or the outfit. Regalia is actually the correct term for that, right?
Yeah, the correct term is regalia. To me, just the word costume, mm-hmm. it makes it seem like it's fake. But regalia, there's actually much thought that goes into it. So family members make pieces of the regalia. They might make some of the beadwork on it. The regalia often has the clan that the person is from. So if you're Bear Clan, there will be some representation that you are from the Bear Clan. Also, the applique that's on the regalias also tell you which tribe you're from. And that varies from each tribe. So Ho-Chunk applique is different from Stockbridge applique, which is different from Oneida, Potawatomi, Ojibwe applique. So.
And is there anything unique about the On Wisconsin annual spring powwow? What happens there in particular?
Yeah, so the On Wisconsin powwow is different because it's bringing together the whole community. It's bringing together both the UW university community as well as the Madison campus area community, and it has an educational component to it. So the whole reason why we put on a powwow is we're trying to provide UW-Madison students with the opportunity to engage in Native culture and for them to learn outside of the classroom and participate in a contemporary Native event and enhance their Wisconsin experience, because that's what the university is about. It's about the Wisconsin experience and the Wisconsin idea. But we're also putting it on for the Native community so that they can come together in Madison, because here in Madison, you have a whole pot of different tribes here. You have Ho-Chunk. Because this is Ho-Chunk land here, so there's a bunch of Ho-Chunk in the area. But then you also have people from Potawatomi, Oneida, Stockbridge, Menominee, and all the six bands of the Ojibwe. And so the On Wisconsin powwow tries to reach every type of audience here, including the children. So we have events educational zones, as we call it, for the children to participate in, which you typically won't see if you go to another tribe's powwow. So this year we'll have a kids corner where they can plant the three sisters. They'll also have coloring sheets where they get to learn about the three sisters. And just to be clear, the three sisters are corns, beans, and squash. So it's the sustenance of our tribe here. We also have a biologist coming from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. So that's also there for the university students who just want to know about that or who's interested in biology in particular. We also have activities that incorporate Native regalia and the languages of the tribes here in Wisconsin. So it's a mix between everything. So I think that educational component to our powwow is what really makes us stand out. In addition to that, we do have the dances in all styles that you would typically see at a powwow, as well as traditional and contemporary art vendors and traditional American Indian food.
We're talking to Faith Bauman, UW-Madison student, member of Wunk Chic, and a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band, looking at the On Wisconsin powwow going on this weekend. So I want to take both communities in turn, people from the public visiting and Native Americans participating. For people, Faith, maybe coming to their first ever powwow, what do they have to see? What are the must-dos for them when they're there?
I would recommend that they come during Grand Entry, because Grand Entry incorporates a lot of what the powwow is about. You see all types of dance styles. They all come in at once. And you also hear the drums that are going to be here singing different songs to welcome everybody to the powwow. You'll get to see or hear the host. You'll get to see who the head dancers are, junior and adult head dancers. You'll also get to see how we honor our veterans. I mean, at a powwow, we always honor them first, and we honor our flags and our nation. So I think they must come to a grand entry. It's grand for a reason. So I think that's one of the must things that they must do. I also think they should try the traditional American Indian food. I don't know if anybody's heard, but fry bread is always a big thing with us, and wild rice. So I would encourage them to try those foods. I would also encourage them to take a look at the traditional contemporary art vendors just to see how the Native community still incorporates our past into our present. There's beadworks from many styles, from different vendors, and they all have their different styles. There's T-shirts, and they take, you know, contemporary images, and they integrate it into Native culture. So I would encourage them to look at that as well.
That's an interesting point. I've seen efforts and campaigns making the case in the United States and in Canada that when you're talking about Native Americans, you're not talking about history. You're not just about history. These are vibrant, living cultures. How important is that message as part of the powwow?
I think that's one of the central messages as well. I mean, you can see in the regalias themselves, like, they are not buckskin. They're made of vibrant colors. Made from material that regular clothes is made from. Like, it clearly is not something of the past. When you talk about our songs, I mean, there's so many songs that the drums sing. Some of them are traditional, but some of them are ones that they've created on their own for specific grand entry. I mean, the words that are spoken may be in the Native languages, but they themselves have their own message that they've created for today. So I think that is reflected in all aspects of our powwow here. I mean, just having the kids' corner is a way for us to bring that past into the present. I mean, we're still holding to our traditional values, but we're teaching it to the children who are here and now so they can know what we do now is not basically the same as what we did in the past. We are just like everyone else. We adapt, we integrate, and we change. We are not this static culture. We are dynamic.
And I understand there's two conferences going on this weekend, the UW-Madison Tribal Technology Institute and the Wisconsin Indian Education Association Conference. Is there overlap between the messages at the powwow and what these conferences might bring together?
I definitely think there could be. I'm not quite sure specifically what each will be talking about, but I do know that at least for the Tribal Technical Institute, the children will be coming to the powwow and they will be meeting with the student organization here on campus, Wunk Chic, to actually talk and see, you know, that basically Native Americans do go to college. We do get an education, and this is their ultimate goal, for you to come to college, for you to get your education so that you can go back to your community and use your knowledge to improve your community. So I definitely know that the Tribal Technical Institute will be at our powwow, and they'll be spending lots of time with the Native American student organization here.
And Faith, before I let you go, I got to ask, what are you looking forward to? What are you most excited about this weekend?
I'm most excited to see all my family members coming. I mean, I'm in Madison 365 days of the year, basically, and my mom and my family members who are on the reservation in Milwaukee, they're coming to our powwow, and they get to see, you know, all the hard work that we put into it. I'm very excited for that, but I'm also very excited to see how other people will react to the powwow and what they learn, because I always find myself in situations where I'm in the class and I already know this, but the questions that other people ask still surprise me. So I'm very excited to see what other people learn from our powwow.
Faith, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Faith Bowman, second-year student at UW-Madison, member of Wunk Chic, and a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of the Mohican Nation. She joined us to talk about the On Wisconsin annual spring powwow this weekend at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison.
Coming up, it flavors everything from your lemonade to your chewing gum. We're going to talk about mint. It's in season now, and it's easy to grow at home. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's Food Friday, and one of the most popular and fragrant herbs is finally in season, mint.
You might find yourself consuming more peppermint, you know, in the winter months or on the holidays, but our next guest has some recipes and ideas for cooking with the refreshing and easy-to-grow herb as the spring weather finally warms up.
Joining us now is Rochelle Bilo. She's senior associate web editor at Bon Appetit and a classically trained cook based in New York. Rochelle, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. I'm thrilled to be time traveling since I'm on the East Coast.
Well, what makes mint a good herb to get excited about and start cooking with in the spring?
Well, one of the things that I love about it is it's so versatile. You can use it. You often see it in desserts, right? How many times have you ordered that, you know, mini chocolate lava cake or that pudding and you have some mint leaves on top? But it's also really great in savory cooking. You can use it to make a pesto. Thin it out with a little arugula or spinach. You can throw it into a salad. It's anywhere you would use fresh herbs like parsley, you can use mint. So it's actually really versatile.
I would worry. I'm a little hesitant to cook with mint in savory things. It seems like it might overpower a lot of dishes. How can I make sure I dial it in enough to taste it, but not so much that it overpowers everything else?
That's a good point. I wouldn't eat a salad made entirely of mint unless maybe I had just eaten some garlic bread before then. But just a little bit goes a long way, for sure. So a salad that I often make at home, actually, is I take some really tender salad greens, like, you know, the spring mix that you can buy in the store. It's mm-hmm. like really tender lettuce leaf, and just break up some mint leaves with my hands. For maybe 2 cups of salad, all you really need is 1/4 cup of mint. And that's just enough to make it taste fresh, but not like you're chewing on an Altoid.
And to be clear, peppermint is different than mint, isn't it?
Well, there are tons of different varieties of mint. There's the ones that we know best are spearmint and peppermint, right? Those are kind of the two varieties that we really know. But if you really want to get a little crazy, you can even buy chocolate mint, which is not brown, but it does have notes of chocolate in it. So there are all sorts of different varieties, sweet mint. And if you're interested in growing them, you know, the seeds are readily available.
We're mainly talking today about fresh mint, right? How important is that versus a dried mint?
You know, so my rule of thumb in cooking is I use dried spices. I think they have great flavor. But if I'm using herbs pretty much across the board, I'm going to go fresh. I really never use dried mint just because the fresh stuff tastes so much better, and yeah, it's really not that expensive, especially if you grow it yourself.
Right. Our producer, Halima, is obsessed with mint. And I asked her, what can you do with mint? And she said, well, everything. And she said it's also pretty easy to grow, which is something I haven't experimented too much with. But how easy is it to grow mint?
You know, not to use an old cliche, but it really does grow like a weed. If you plant it outdoors, it will just take over your garden. But you can grow it in a pot. In your house or on your windowsill, just make sure it gets plenty of light. It really loves sunshine. So it doesn't have to be in the sunlight the entire day, but make sure it has a good chunk of time when it's in the sun. Water it regularly. And then the other thing to keep in mind is you want to keep harvesting from your mint plant. You don't want to let it go to the point where it starts flowering because that means that the plant has gone by and the taste will be a little off. So all you have to do is just take your fingers and pinch off little bits here and there. And, you know, if you don't have any cooking projects planned, you can use the mint leaves to make a simple syrup and keep it in your fridge for iced tea or cocktails. But you really just want to harvest it regularly so it doesn't get out of control.
We're talking to Rochelle Bylow. She's a classically trained cook, and she's cooking with mint with us today. We've got some recipes, by the way, that she pointed us toward, linked at the Central Time Facebook page. Rochelle, before we get to particular recipes, say we want to experiment. If we want to play around with mint, what kind of flavors does it work well with in our savory cooking in particular?
I think that mint actually has some really nice sweet undertones. So I think that it's actually kind of counterintuitively best with really bitter and spicy notes because it contrasts. So one of my favorite things is to do a stir fry with tons of fresh chilies. I'll use Fresno chilies or Thai hot chilies, throw them in there, and then at the last minute when everything is cooked, whether it's, you know, tofu or tempeh or veggies or chicken or beef or whatever, just throw in a big handful of mint and basil leaves, and it just brightens the whole thing up, and it also helps counteract the heat that you get from the chilies. So while it's good in sweet things, I think it's really, really great in spicy cuisines, because you need a little balance.
A lot of people like to go kind of sweet when they're talking about mint, and you've got, you sent us a couple recipes to check out involving syrup for iced tea and also mint for mojitos. Can you walk us through some of the drink applications?
Yeah, definitely. So making a simple syrup is one of the easiest and most satisfying kitchen tasks that you can master. All you really have to do is heat together equal parts sugar and water, or, you know, a little more, a little less sugar, depending on how sweet you like things. And then let it cool down. And when it cools, it's thick and viscous and syrupy. So you can add any flavor that you want to that, whether it's lavender or cinnamon sticks. That would be great in spring or winter, respectively, but you can do the same with mint. And then once it's cool, you just strain out the leaves and discard them, put them in your compost pile. And then you have a minty syrup, so it's a little bit sweet and it's a little bit minty. And to sweeten drinks, all you have to do is just stir a tablespoon or two into your pitcher of fresh brewed iced tea. Or I think one of the recipes that I pointed you to was a pineapple mint mojito, which is so good and so dangerous.
And I think of the mojito, is there muddling involved? Does that help bring out the flavor in a drink?
Definitely. You know, if you make the simple syrup, you're adding mint flavor there. But a great home bartender trick is any fresh ingredient, whether it's fruit or herbs, you want to muddle it before. And muddling it basically just means kind of breaking it up.
Smushing
with
it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Smushing it around. You can even use the back of a spoon to do this. You don't have to have any fancy bar equipment. But the more you do that, the more flavor is released because you're kind of breaking into those little essential oils. And plus, it makes you look like a professional. So.
Well, I love buying fresh herbs, growing them, but it seems like one of the problems when you have to buy them, like in the winter, say in Wisconsin, you get one use out of them and then you've got a whole lot of herb left over.
Yeah.
Right. And what do you do with the herbs that you've got left over? Is there a way to preserve them longer once you've cut them?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I think For starters, storing them in the fridge properly is key. Now, everyone has a different way of doing this, I will admit, but I have found that the best success I have with storing fresh herbs is wrapping them very gently in a cool, damp paper towel and putting them in an unsealed plastic bag. And this might be a little precious and a little extra work, but every day I kind of dampen that paper towel, just get it just moist, you know, not sopping wet, and then just put it back in the unsealed bag. And I've had success keeping mint and fresh, more tender herbs like basil or cilantro fresh for about a week with that method. But you can also use it to make a pesto. Again, to Rob's point, you wouldn't want to use all mint because that would be a little too much, but you can do half basil, half mint, or you know, you can make a pesto with pretty much anything green, even kale or spinach. Throw a few mint leaves in there, the ones that are about to go bad. And actually, that's a great thing to do with mint that's about to wilt or any green that's about to wilt. Just turn it into a sauce or a pesto in your food processor, and no one will have ever known. And that keeps for, you know, a couple of weeks indefinitely if you freeze it.
We're talking to Bon Appetit Senior Associate Web Editor and classically trained cook Rochelle Bylo about cooking with mint on today's edition of Food Friday.
And we'd love to hear from you. Have you grown mint before? Any ideas for how to grow it in your own home or your garden? And what is your favorite way to use it now that we're coming into the thick of mint season? Maybe you've got a question about cooking with mint for Rochelle. Well, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or comment on some of the mint-focused recipes that we've got posted right now on the Central Time Facebook page. You can tell us your favorite way to cook with mint. Call in at 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's Food Friday, and we're picking up our conversation now with Bon Appetit Senior Associate Web Editor and classically trained cook Rochelle Bylo. And we're talking about recipes that feature mint. It's in time for spring and mint season, and we want to hear from you on this.
Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you cook with mint? Do you grow mint? Do you use it in desserts, in entrees, in drinks? What do you like mint for? What do you like to use it for? Or do you have a question about what you can do with mint that Rochelle can maybe answer for us? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Post on the Central Time Facebook page. Find some recipes there.
And Rochelle, you sent us a recipe that you like from the web, and this one is called Frigola with Green Peas, Mint, and Ricotta. Can you tell us about that one?
Yes. What I love about this recipe is it's basically spring in a bowl. You know, you have your fresh green peas, which thanks to the freezer section in our grocery stores, you know, we can get green peas all year round. But there's something really special about those first spring green peas. And mint and ricotta, those are all really bright, fresh flavors. It's kind of a little bit brothy, so it's a little bit pasta dish, a little bit of a soup. And then you just throw some fresh ricotta on there. Oh, gosh, it's amazing. It's so good. And if you check out, I think you guys posted the recipe on your Facebook page. If you check out the picture, you can see there's not a ton of mint on there. Just a little bit like you would throw some parsley on a dish to brighten it up. You can do that with mint. I think there's also maybe a little bacon in there too, which never hurt. Never hurt anything.
Well, let's go to our callers now. We've got Todd on the line in Madison. Todd, hi.
Hi. I've got a really nice recipe for mint with New York strip steaks.
Ooh, how does that work?
Whoa.
Well, it works really well. First off, heat an oven to about 4 1/4. Then you want to have an oven-proof pan, okay? Then you mix 3 tablespoons of Dijon mustard, a couple tablespoons of honey, a tablespoon of horseradish, and then about 4 mint leaves, really, really finely diced, right? Really get a really nice chop on them. Mix that up. That's the glaze. Okay, then take your New York strip, heat the pan up really nice and warm, put a dry rub, you know, kind of a spicy dry rub, or whatever kind you like, on one side of the steak. Drop it in that hot pan for about a minute, right, till it gets crusty. Flip it over, then throw the whole pan in the oven for 8 minutes. At the 6-minute point, take the pan out, put some of that glaze on it, and put it back in for 2 minutes. take it out, and then as you let the steaks rest, put a little more of that glaze on the top of it, let it sit for 5 minutes. It's really good.
And Todd, I guess the big question for you is, when can we stop by after the show tonight to try this out?
I'm sorry, I'm working tonight, but...
Oh, okay. Well, maybe next time. Yeah. Todd, thanks so much. So, mint with meat, with beef in this case, Rochelle. Any other suggestions or ideas for mint and our meat dishes?
Well, you know, that totally makes sense to me because in some of my favorite Asian-inspired stir-fry dishes, like I'll stir-fry beef really thinly sliced so it cooks quickly, and, you know, throw some hot chilies and garlic and just tons of lime juice in there and throw mint in too. So when he first said mint on a strip steak, I thought, what? But, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I was like, I guess I know what I'm doing for dinner tonight. And, you know, one thing he did say that was great about that recipe is he adds the glaze when the meat is halfway done cooking, which is really smart because if you add that kind of lacquered glaze on too early, it might burn. So he's a guy who knows what he's doing in the kitchen.
All right. We'll have to have Todd on as a guest sometime, maybe. Well, appreciate that, Todd. And we're going to go next to Sam calling from Eau Claire. Sam, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, do you have any ideas how you could make essential oil out of the mint?
Okay. Essential oil from mint. What do you think, Rochelle?
Interesting. I love essential oils, but I've never made them myself. I'm sure you could. You know, I don't have an immediate answer for that, although I wish I did, and in part just for selfish purposes. One thing I have done, this is, you know, not what you're asking at all, but I've infused alcohols with mint, and so I wonder if the infusion process might be similar, you know, slowly heating up a really neutral oil, so not olive oil because that has a ton of flavor and scent to it individually, but something really mild like grapeseed oil maybe, and heating that up slowly with the mint and then letting it cool down and straining out the mint. Might have a weekend project. I'll try it and report back.
All right, thanks. It's Sam. Good luck. I hope you can find a way to do that. I wanted to ask about tabbouleh, Rochelle. That's one, when I think of savory dishes with mint, that's one that pops into my head. I've never made it myself, I gotta say, and look at the recipe you pointed us toward. Easier than I thought it would be.
So easy. And one of the biggest misconceptions about tabbouleh is people think it's a big grain salad. But the point of a tabbouleh is really fresh veggies and tons of great herbs with a little bit of grains in there. It's often made with bulgur wheat, which is a cracked, quick-cooking wheat. But the recipe I gave you is actually made with millet, which is a smaller, even quicker cooking grain. Cooks up in about 15 minutes. And then you fluff it, really similar to the way that you fluff couscous once it's done cooking. And then just throw a bunch of fresh herbs in there, lemon juice, salt, and any fresh herbs that you want, and you've made tabbouleh.
We're talking mint today for Food Friday with Rochelle Bylow. She is a senior associate web editor at Bon Appetit. And as long as we're talking tabbouleh, let's talk about some yummy yogurt sauce to put on the tabbouleh. And this is something I often think of maybe putting dill in, but how does mint fit in this picture?
Oh, man. Well, I love yogurt sauce. In fact, it's probably the one thing that I make multiple times a week. You know, I'm always making new recipes, testing things out for Bon Appetit, but that's my go-to, is a really good savory yogurt sauce. And the way to make it taste like a sauce and not your morning yogurt that you're eating for breakfast with granola is to add some really savory ingredients. So I'll add chopped garlic or maybe some sautéed onions that I've cooked down, and then throwing that mint in there, a little drizzle of olive oil to thin it out, especially if you have a thicker style yogurt. You want it to be spoonable, not, you know, concrete like with your, you know, if you have Greek yogurt or thick strained yogurt. So, and then that's great on anything. You can even use it as a dip for chips, which, you know, sometimes dinner in the middle of the week.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Jeff on the line in Toma. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I was going to say my wife grows mojito mint for mojitos, and put the mojito mint in the bottom of the glass, and then you wanted to crush it up just to agitate the mint, and And then there's multiple mojito mixes already, which are non-alcoholic.
Oh.
And then if you want to, obviously, if you want to refresh it up, then you can put, most people put rum in it, and then like a 7-Up, you know, that type of soda in with it. And I always put, I crush the mint up, and then I put pure cane sugar on top of the mint. Not really sure. I know they do it in Mexico. Not really sure what it accomplishes, but it just brings out a more, more vibrant flavor. And like I said, the mojito mixes, you can, you know, kind of do it to taste. I also noticed in a couple of magazines where they substituted the 7-Up or that type of drink with tea.
All right, Jeff, mojitos, a great warm weather drink, Rochelle, or a great winter drink if you want to pretend it's warm weather.
Definitely. And it's, I got to say, it's, you know, 3 minutes to 5 here on the East Coast, so.
Almost mojito time? Is that what you're saying?
Mojito time.
Well, what about one area we haven't talked about, just really briefly, Rochelle, but stir fries. How does mint work in stir fries?
Well, the key with adding mint or any fresh herb, cilantro, basil, parsley, to a stir fry is you don't want to add it too early, because you know what happens when you throw those fresh, tender leaves into the pan. They wilt up really fast. It's like when you put a bunch of spinach in the pan and it seems like a ton, and then it cooks and 2 minutes later you're left with, you know, half a cup of spinach. Herbs do the same thing, so you really don't want to add them until the very end, even after you take the pan off the heat. You know, give it one last stir, throw those herbs in. The heat of the pan will help them release all of that fragrance and just get your taste buds ready to go, and they won't be soggy. They'll be perfectly pert.
That's a great tip to leave it with. Rochelle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm now hungry and thirsty.
That's Rochelle Bylo. She's senior associate web editor at Bon Appetit and a classically trained cook based in New York. She talked to us about cooking with mint for this week's Food Friday. You can see some of the recipes we've been talking about linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
As you probably noticed, well, today is April 1st, otherwise known as April Fool's Day.
Lots of media organizations get in on the prankage with zany stories. We're not doing that today. We're just not that creative. Plus, pranks can lead to trouble, as Google found out when their April Fool's email add-on had a lot of people accidentally sending, you know, important business emails, they thought, that turned out to actually just be cartoon minions dropping a microphone.
It was a really funny clip from that movie, by the way, but I can see out of context, it might not have gone over.
Here's
so
the
well.
Annual report, boss.
Yeah, there were some pretty bad scenarios that I read about. Well, April Fool's shenanigans, they do have a long history, possibly going back to Roman times, and the U.S. isn't alone. A lot of other countries have their own traditions, including France's Poisson d'Avril, which sounds so cool, the fish of April. The custom is to try to stick paper pictures of fish on other people's backs. And Rob, you actually tried this.
Right. I couldn't not do it, given that we have Judith Sears Poisson on the Central Time team. I had to try to make the Judith Sears Poisson d'Avril, I don't know how to pronounce French, went off without a hitch, except that she immediately noticed that I snuck up behind her and that I was taping something to her. So it was only on there for like a split second.
Right, and I'm taking some of these Poisson d'Avril home, and I'm going to try
a
this. Because all of my April Fool's jokes have failed this morning, except for the one where you thought I ate your donut, but I didn't.
Yeah, yeah. I at least you owned up before I started crying.
Yeah, I'm with Google. Things are just not going my way on this April Fool's Day.
Well, stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.